The winning candidate last November, early this month, received about 31% of the eligible vote. The loser, 29%. The results were very close to what they had been in the year 2000. The same, virtually the same red and blue states, as they're called. A few percentage shift in the vote, which is almost a random event, would have meant that Kerry had won, also telling us nothing about the country and the electorate. The reason is that issues of substance were very consciously kept out of the campaign. You have to remember that political campaigns are designed by the same industries that sell toothpaste and cars and so on. It's not an exaggeration. They're run by the public relations industry. What is their professional concern and their regular vocation? Well, it's not to provide information. Their goal, rather, is deceit. And that's not a secret. Every time you turn on the tube, you see it. Hundreds of billions of dollars a year are spent in what's called advertising, which does not, say, list the properties of next year's cars, as would happen in an unimaginable market society based on what you study in economics courses, informed consumer choice. That's a total myth. Rather, just take a look at the advertising. It tells you why. The point is not to present information. It's to deceive you. That's why the car, they don't, like GM doesn't tell you, here's what I'm going to produce next year. It takes, you know, 1 minute, no money. What it does is show the car with a, you know, sexy model in it or a sports hero or, you know, doing some ridiculous thing like climbing up a sheer cliff or something like that. And it's some, what it, the point is, and it's true of the whole hundreds of billions of dollars, is to project some kind of an image that might deceive the consumer into buying this car instead of the virtually identical one produced by a competitor. That's the prime commitment of the public relations industry and a way of, one of the many ways of undermining the mythology about markets, which nobody believes in unless you can force them on someone else. And the same is true with elections, which are run by the PR industry. The goal is to project images and to deceive the public into accepting them while sidelining issues for very good reasons, to which I'll come back. And the population knows it. You know, they're not stupid. About 10% of voters say their choice is based on the candidates, reading the polling question, on the candidates' agendas, ideas, platforms, and goals. That's 6% of Kerry voters and 13% of Bush voters, otherwise essentially nobody. The rest rely on what the industry calls qualities and values. So does the candidate project the image of a strong leader, the kind of guy you'd like to meet in a bar, or somebody who cares about you and is just like you? My guess, I have no evidence, but I'm just guessing, is that Bush is very carefully trained to say things like nuclear and misunderestimate and all the other silliness that intellectuals like to ridicule. That's probably about as real as the ranch that was constructed for him and the rest of the whole folksy manner. After all, it would hardly do to present him as a spoiled frat boy from Yale who became rich and powerful because of his rich and powerful connections and family. Rather, the imagery projected has to be a guy just like us, you know, not one of these fancy types, a guy who will protect us, who cares about us, who shares about our moral values. That's the imagery, which is about as real as in toothpaste ads. Not surprisingly, it's done by the same people. Bush, in that case, the point is to undermine markets. In this case, the point is to undermine democracy. It's the same principle. Bush, if you look, received a large majority among voters who said that they were concerned primarily with moral values and terrorism. As for Bush's moral values, there's an easy way to find out what they are. Read the business press the day after the election. It describes what it called the euphoria in corporate boardrooms and so on. That's not because CEOs are opposed to gay marriage. Most of them are what are called liberals. I mean, their social values are about the same as, you know, a Canadian dimension, probably. If you want to learn more about their moral value, the Bush moral values, just observe the principle, basic principle, which is not concealed. The principle is that costs are to be transferred to your children and your grandchildren. Now, that's environmental costs, fiscal costs, and the rest. It's not concealed. And those are indeed the moral values. Now, the point of the PR industry is to prevent you from seeing anything as obvious as that. What about terror? Well, the fact of the matter is that Bush's planners escalated the threat of terror, and pretty consciously. It had been predicted, even by their own intelligence agencies, that would be the consequence of the war in Iraq, and it turned out to be true. And they did it because it's just not a high priority for them, surely as compared with much more serious goals, such as establishing secure military bases in a dependent client state right at the heart of the world's energy resources. Well, you know, that's really important. It's critically important to ensure that the huge profits, one historian of the industry calls them profits beyond the dream of avarice, it's important to ensure that they go into the right pockets. Even meaning U.S. energy corporations, and in fact much more than that, the U.S. Treasury, high-tech industry, which is sells weapons and so on, construction corporations and so on, you know, Bechtel and the rest of them. And even more important than the ensuring that the huge profits beyond the dream of avarice go to the right place, certainly not to the people of the region, that's out of the question, but not to competitors either, mostly to the U.S. Much more important than that is the what was called the stupendous strategic importance of the Middle East region back 60 years ago, and it's been understood ever since. Namely, having a hand on the spigot guarantees what planners 50 years ago called veto power over others. It's George Kennan, favored it, of course. Just his successor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, wrote a couple of months ago that controlling Iraq gives the United States critical leverage over European and Asian economies, veto power, in other words. And controlling those rivals has been a major concern of policy planners ever since the Second World War. They are, to quote Henry Kissinger, they're supposed to keep to their regional responsibilities within the overall framework of order managed by the United States. That's what Kissinger instructed Europeans in his Year of Europe address 30 years ago. Sometimes they get out of line, so if so, you can use the critical leverage. That's now much more urgent than it was in the past, as they keep threatening to move in an independent course, maybe even united. So the European Union and China have became each other's leading trading partners last year. And these ties are becoming even tighter. And now includes the world's second largest economy, Japan. So critical leverage is more important than ever for world control in what's sometimes called a tripolar world, three major power centers that has been evolving for 40 years and now much more so. In comparison to this, the threat of terror is a pretty minor consideration, although the threat is known to be awesome. Long before 9/11, it was clearly understood, written about in technical publications, that sooner or later the jihadist terror that was organized by the U.S. and its allies in the 1980s is likely to combine with weapons of mass destruction, which could have horrifying consequences, but it's just not a high priority. Those who thought they were voting for somebody who's going to protect them from terror and has their moral values are severely deceived. That's the point of advertising and public relations. Well, U.S. public opinion is actually studied with great care and depth, and we know a lot about it. There were major studies released by the most prestigious outfits right before the election and they showed that people planning to vote for Bush assumed that the Republican Party shared their views, even though the party explicitly rejected them, as was shown. And pretty much the same is true of Kerry supporters. It's modified slightly if you give a very sympathetic interpretation of occasional vague statements that most voters had probably never even heard. The major concerns of Kerry supporters were the economy and health care, and they assumed, falsely as it turns out, that he shared their views on these matters, just as Bush voters assumed falsely that the Republicans shared their views. So, summarize all this. Among those who bothered to vote, they mostly accepted the imagery that was concocted by the PR industry, just as in the non-existent markets that were taught about in economics courses. And the imagery had only the vaguest resemblance to reality. That's, of course, apart from the more wealthy, who do tend to vote their class interests, apparently even more so in 2004 than 2000, which probably accounts for most of the small difference between these 2 years. Well, what about actual public attitudes? That's crucially important, especially for those who want to change the world. Well, again, right before the election, October, major studies were released reporting public attitudes in the United States. And when you look at the results, which are barely reported, you see right away why elections have to keep to deceit, much as in the fake markets that we're taught to revere. Now, here's a couple of examples of public attitudes, virtually quoting from the studies. A considerable majority of the population believe that the United States should accept the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court and the World Court. It's rejected by both parties. That it should sign the Kyoto Protocols, that it should rely on the United Nations to take the lead in international crises, including security, reconstruction, and political transition in Iraq. That's been true for a year and a half. And even a majority believes that the United States should abandon the Security Council veto and follow UN decisions even if it doesn't approve of them. Majority, again, believe that that the U.S. should rely on diplomatic and economic measures more than military ones in the so-called war on terror. And here's a crucial one. The U.S. should use force only if, I'm quoting, there is strong evidence that the country is in imminent danger of being attacked. That means a large majority reject the bipartisan consensus on so-called preemptive war and adopt a rather conventional interpretation of the UN Charter. Overwhelming majorities of the public favor the expansion of purely domestic programs, primarily health care, it's 80%, but also expanded aid to education and expanding Social Security, also like 60-70%. That's been found for years in the same studies carried out by the most reputable organizations that monitor public opinion. In other mainstream polls, 80% favor universal health care. That's something that's also been true for a long time. The numbers vary depending on exactly how the questions are asked. Occasionally, the press discusses this. It says, yeah, everybody seems to want it. But there's a phrase for it. It's called politically impossible. That's why the New York Times describes how the New York Times has described it in the past. Just again, a couple of days before the election, the New York Times had an article on this, and here's what it said. It says, there is so little political support for government intervention in the health care market in the United States. That's not universal health care, but any government intervention in the health care market. There's so little political support for it that John Kerry took pains in a recent presidential debate to say that his plan for expanding access to health insurance would not create a new government program. That is what the large majority of the population want. But it's politically impossible, and that's correct. It's opposed by the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical industry, and Wall Street, so it's therefore politically impossible in a country where the elite not only doesn't pretend that it's a democracy, but doesn't want it to be. So, like, if 80% of the population wants something, it's politically impossible and has no political support if it's not supported in the places that matter. Well, I could go on with these studies, which are quite interesting, but one interesting thing about them is that they are held by people in virtual isolation. They rarely hear them. They probably regard them as idiosyncratic, like I'm the only person in the country who thinks this. They don't enter into political campaigns. They only enter very marginally into articulate opinion in the media and journals. And the same extends to other domains. And it raises quite important questions about what we call a democratic deficit when we're talking about others. Some of these cases are very revealing. So you remember that last March, Spanish voters voted out a government which had gone to war in opposition to about 90% of the population. Well, when the Spanish government did go to war, joining the U.S. over huge, almost universal objection, it was very highly praised in the United States and Britain and much of the West. Because it was described, as you remember, what was called the New Europe, the hope for the future, the hope for democracy, namely countries that, if you look at the criterion that distinguished the good guys, New Europe, from the bad guys, Old Europe, it was very straightforward, almost impossible to miss. It took real dedication to the party line to miss it, and it was universally missed almost. The criterion was if a government takes the same position as the overwhelming majority of the population, it's old Europe, you know, the bad guys, as it doesn't have democratic credentials. That was the term that was actually used. On the other hand, if the government follows the orders from Crawford, Texas, and overrules the vast majority of the population, around 90% in Spain's case, then it's the hope for the democratic future. Tells you a lot about the conception of democracy. Well, last March, Spanish voters voted out that government, and they were bitterly condemned for appeasing terror, and you remember all of that. I didn't see anybody point out that the voters in Spain took almost exactly the same position as about 70% of Americans south of the border. About 70% of people in the United States were in favor of what I just said, transferring authority for reconstruction, security, political transfer in Iraq to the United Nations. In fact, that had been true for about a year at that time. And that's what the Spanish voters voted for. They didn't vote for pulling out the troops. They said leaving them there only under UN authority. Well, there's a difference between Spain and the United States. In Spain, people knew what public opinion was. In the United States, to find it out, you got to do a research project. It's there, but you got to do some work. And in Spain, people could vote for it. In the United States, completely off the electoral agenda. It's really important to keep issues out of the electoral agenda because of popular attitudes. We could ask, what would the result be if the parties, let's say either of them, had been willing to articulate people's concerns, even on the issues that people pick as most important? Or what would happen if such issues were allowed to enter mainstream discussion? Well, about that, we can only speculate, but we do know that it doesn't happen and that the facts are barely even reported. And it seems reasonable to surmise that it's fear of the great beast that lies behind that, and it's pretty deep. Well, the operative conception of democracy is also revealed very clearly in the international arena, as in the case I mentioned and others. Let's take a current case, the death of Yasser Arafat. The lead think piece in the New York Times by their kind of house lefty intellectual on the death of Arafat, the lead story think piece said, opened by saying this: the post-Arafat era will be the latest test of a quintessentially American article of faith, that elections provide legitimacy even to the frailest institutions. Read down to the last paragraph on the continuation page, and you read, Washington resisted new national elections among the Palestinians because Arafat would win and gain a fresher mandate, and they might help give credibility and authority to other people the U.S. doesn't like. In other words, democracy is fine if you're sure that the results are going to come out the right way. That's the quintessential faith. And we see that very dramatically right now in the case of Iraq, very dramatically. A year ago, after all the other pretexts had collapsed, Bush's speechwriters came along with a new one to replace them. It's what the liberal press calls the president's messianic vision to bring democracy to Iraq, Middle East, whole world. And the reactions were kind of intriguing. They ranged from rapturous acclaim in the liberal national press, from praise for the it ranged from there to critics. The critics agreed that the vision was noble and inspiring, but they said it might be beyond our reach. The problem is that Iraqi culture is just not ready for such progress towards civilized values. But it was interesting that it was presupposed across the spectrum that this was the goal of the invasion. Well, there's evidence for that, one piece of evidence. Our leader proclaimed it. What more is needed? The critics say noble vision, but we have to temper the messianic idealism of Bush and Blair with sober realism. Now, that's the London Financial Times, probably the most serious newspaper in the world. Well, actually, there is, you can tell me what the Canadian press said. I'll make a guess, but you can verify it for me. Well, there actually was one sector of opinion that had a different view, Iraqis. At the very same time as the messianic vision was proclaimed in Washington to reverent applause, there was a U.S.-run poll in Baghdad. And it turned out that some people there also believed that that was the goal of the invasion, 1%. A majority of the population took the obvious view. The U.S. invaded Iraq to get control of its resources and to organize the region in U.S. interests. The view you're not allowed to express in the United States, or you're a conspiracy theorist or a Marxist or some other bad word. In fact, Iraqis agree that there's a problem of cultural backwardness that stands in the way of the messianic vision, but they think it's here, not in Iraq. Actually, their views are a little more nuanced if you look. So 1% thought the U.S. invaded to restore establish democracy, but 50% said the U.S. wants democracy in Iraq. Now, that may look like a contradiction until you go on. 50% said the U.S. wants democracy, but is going to influence it to ensure that it comes out the right way. In other words, they understand very well the quintessentially American faith, perhaps because it was also the quintessentially British faith, while Britain's boot was on their neck since the First World War. And they don't have to know the history of Wilsonian idealism, as it's called, or Britain's noble counterpart, or the French civilizing mission, or the even more exalted vision of Japanese fascists and many others. It's presumably close to a historical universal. Their own experience is enough. And it's not unusual for those at the wrong end of the club to have a much clearer picture of reality than those who are wielding it. That's true in plenty of domains. Well, at the outset, I mentioned very briefly the very notable successes of popular struggles in the past decades. It's pretty clear if you think about it a little, very rarely discussed for reasons that aren't hard to discern. Both recent history and public attitudes suggest some pretty straightforward and quite conservative strategies for short-term activism on the part of those who don't want to wait for China to save us from ultimate doom. We do enjoy great privilege and freedom, in fact, uniquely so by comparative and historical standards. That legacy was not granted as a gift from above. It was won. It was won by hard and dedicated struggle, which doesn't reduce to pushing a lever every few years. We can, of course, decide to abandon the legacy. You can take the easy way of pessimism. You know, everything's hopeless, so I quit. or we can make use of that legacy and work to create, in part to recreate, the basis for a functioning democratic culture in which the public plays some role in determining policies, not only in the political arena, from which it's largely excluded, but in the crucial economic arena, from which it is excluded in principle. Now, those are not particularly radical ideas. So, for example, they were articulated very clearly by the leading 20th century social philosopher in the United States, John Dewey, who's American as apple pie in the familiar phrase. He pointed out that until what he called industrial feudalism is replaced by industrial democracy, politics will remain the shadow cast by business over society. Now, Dewey wasn't being particularly original in that. In fact, he was drawing from a long tradition of thought and action that had developed independently in working class culture from the very origins of the Industrial Revolution, actually right where I live, an area near Boston in the mid-19th century. Those ideas remain just below the surface, and they can become a living part of our societies and our cultures and our institutions. But like other victories for justice and freedom over the centuries, that's not going to happen by itself. One of the clearest lessons of history, including very recent history, is that rights are not granted. They are won, and the rest of it's up to us.